You are listening to an ADIS podcast.
Well, welcome to the podcast, Biomarker Testing for Actionable Alterations in Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer, Perspectives from a U.S.-based Academic and Community Oncologist. I'm Dr. Wade Imes in Thoracic Medical Oncology at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, here with my colleague, Dr. Kanduri.
Hi, I'm Karthik Kanduri. I'm a part of Texas Oncology and part of the broad network of U.S. Oncology, but primarily work at Baylor University Medical Center, where we work at the Lung and Esophageal Cancer Research Center in Dallas. So I'll kick off. The first part of this discussion is about biomarker testing and why is it important in non-small cell lung cancer. So as we all know, non-small cell lung cancer is the most common type of lung cancer, and of course, it comprises a multiple type and variety of histologies. We all know that some of the major types include adenocarcinomas and small squamous cell carcinomas, but of course, there are certain other types, including some smaller incidences of large cell carcinomas and large cell neuroendocrine carcinomas, etc. And, you know, over a period of time, we have seen that the prognosis for non-small cell lung cancer has been steadily improving because of our ability to understand the disease process better, understand molecular drivers, and utilize immunotherapies. So in this section, we'll have a chat about the considerations for prognosis and how we are utilizing biomarker testing. Dr. Imes?
Absolutely. Totally agree, Dr. Kanduri. And one way that I explain the situation of biomarker testing in patients with non-small cell lung cancer when I'm having conversations with patients is the unfortunate reality that most patients have stage four disease at diagnosis. And the overall prognosis, historically, when we look at chemotherapy and even immunotherapy for the median survival is still within 1 to 2 years with treatment for those patients. So it's a very severe prognosis. And I talk in terms of the three broad categories of treatments we have today and the ways to beat the average. And the three broad categories being cytotoxic chemotherapy, immunotherapy, most commonly pembrolizumab with or without chemotherapy for these patients, and then oncogene-directed targeted therapies. And really, to beat the average, if you're eligible for an oncogene-directed targeted therapy, you'll typically beat the average. And if you have exceptional benefit from immune therapy, then you can really blow the average out of the water. So that's kind of what we focus on and really highlights the importance of biomarker testing in estimating the patients who may beat the average with immune therapy with very high PD-L1 scores, for example, and of course, identifying patients eligible for oncogene-directed therapies.
Yeah, very good point. As we have gone through the last many years, perhaps the last decade, we have been able to pick up more and more biomarkers that we are using. And there are guidelines by various international guideline agencies that talk about doing testing in appropriate circumstances and how to test for not just biomarkers and the consideration for evaluation of these biomarkers and how to use them for targeted therapies for our patients. That is something what we sort of say as personalized medicine. And there have been many treatment approvals in the last years, including immunotherapy, as you talked about, Dr. Imes, and then considerations for targeted therapies. And as we have gone through these discoveries and have started using these medicines in our clinic, the incorporation in terms of how to test for these in an effective manner, it becomes paramount importance. And because of that, it sort of behooves us to understand the perspectives of how to test and how to treat our patients in this situation. So from a community perspective, I would say that the importance of biomarker testing, of course, in all non-small cell lung cancer is very paramount, but in a community perspective, there still remains a big gap in terms of testing as well as its utilization in the personalized therapy for our patients. We will try to explore this over a period of time, but we've seen that many of our community practices still struggle with the ability to do testing. There are certainly improvements and trends over the last few years about testing in the various community practices that I interact with, but nevertheless, some more ground needs to be covered, and it's still a work in progress. What are your experiences, Dr. Imes?
I think a lot of the push in academics is to getting the biomarker testing done as a reflex. And in my mind, there's really two broad categories of biomarkers that we're testing for, generally PD by immunohistochemistry and our broad-based next generation sequencing testing, which is more involved and generally takes longer. It's not just an overnight immunohistochemistry stain. And recently at Vanderbilt, we have been successful at getting reflex testing done so that for all non-small cell lung cancer diagnoses, PD-L1 and a broad-based next-generation sequencing panel is initiated by pathology. For the last several years, that process had to be initiated by medical oncology. And I think that's okay, but there's sometimes a few week interval between that diagnosis and patients being able to establish in the oncology clinic. So really trying to narrow that turnaround time. And one of the things that's actually helped reflex being approved across the medical center, and this is what I hear from academic colleagues as well, is the fact that it's not only just stage four patients now that can benefit from this biomarker testing with the introduction of immune therapy and EGFR inhibitors, osimertinib, for patients with resected non-small cell lung cancer. Now it's relevant for patients with early stage disease. So that was really a decisive argument within our medical center that, hey, now all our patients need it. It's not just stage four patients. So it's given the pathologist more comfort in reflex ordering and knowing that it's going to be clinically relevant. I don't know if that's also been a factor for you as well.
Yeah, I echo that completely. At Baylor University Medical Center, we have been doing reflex testing in all stages. And as you rightly mentioned, it has become more relevant and pertinent to multiple stages across non-small cell lung cancer therapy, as you said. And it is something that I hope my colleagues in community practice will also pick up and the trend will improve. Of course, there is still some ways to go, as I mentioned just now. And the hope is that as time goes by in the near future, many more test evaluations will be through a reflexive way, if possible. And if not, at least in a time-efficient manner, such that it's applicable for the treatment for our patients in a quick turnaround time.
Absolutely. So we're going to talk a bit about the common biomarkers in non-small cell lung cancer. So just getting into the details a little bit, kind of distinguishing the three broad categories of biomarkers that we think about in patients with non-small cell lung cancer are diagnostic, prognostic, and predictive. So diagnostic biomarkers we're all very familiar with, such as TTF1, NAPS-A to diagnose an adenocarcinoma subtype, P4 to diagnose a squamous subtype in a patient with non-small cell. So those are our diagnostic biomarkers that pathologists are very facile with using to identify patients there. Prognostic biomarkers are biomarkers that don't have therapeutic implications for what treatment will work, but provide insight into likely outcome. Specifically, TP53 in patients with non-small cell lung cancer has been associated across scenarios to have a worse prognosis. And then predictive biomarkers are those biomarkers that can tell us likelihood of benefit from specific therapies. So these do include PD-L1, higher PD-L1, of course, predictive of increased likelihood of benefit from pembrolizumab, most common immune therapy, or other PD-L1 inhibitors in patients with non-small cell lung cancer. And then Dr. Kanduri, I wanted you to talk a little bit more about those oncogene-directed targetable mutations. We've got so many now, and it's a really different world these days.
Doubt. It certainly is. And hopefully we just continue to find more and more of these markers that we can use to help our patients. And of course, as you mentioned, there are so many such that immunotherapy has its own. And now we are talking about targeted therapies with ALK rearrangements, with BRAF and EGFR mutations, HER2 mutations and KRAS mutations, of course, and MET exon 14. And there are other NRG1 fusions, NTRK fusions, et cetera, which also are rarer subtypes of markers, but certainly are prevalent in the non-small cell lung cancer space. But we have certain treatments which are very effective, for example, for NTRK. And I would also say that there are other new things that we are looking at, like MET amplifications and HER2 amplifications, which can sometimes be associated with resistance mechanisms and in some circumstances, et cetera. So this is an exciting time for non-small cell lung cancer. And as we go along, we hope to find more markers that we can have effective treatment strategies for our patients.
Absolutely. It's an exciting time, and we continue to identify new targets with new targeted therapies. And so I think it's very important to follow this research as it evolves within thoracic oncology.
So we want to talk a little bit about actionable biomarkers and how do you test and what are the guidelines and what treatment recommendations are considered for these guidelines in this section. Between the various biomarkers that we have talked about as just in the prior section, what kind of evaluation should you undertake? And there are national guidelines institutions, including NCCN, ESMO, and other practice guidelines, as well as pathology-based tissue testing guidelines that are also available for testing and how do you test them in a particular manner that is efficient, which conserves tissue, which has the ability to do the testing in an effective turnaround time such that we can test for all these potential actionable mutations or gene alterations and be able to get a result in one shot rather than having to go reflexively multiple times so that it does not waste time for putting in therapy for our patients. And the NCCN and the ESMO clinical practice guidelines are available for anyone to look at. And I would urge people to look at them so that they can get a broad understanding of how to recognize or which biomarkers to recognize that are currently in practice. Dr. Yumsio.
Yep, absolutely agree. And the way that I think of the way the guidelines are written is it pretty much hems to where we have therapeutic applications for these oncogenic drivers, just quickly because we've got so many, but it's amazing to just rattle through what are all recommended to be tested for in patients with non-small cell lung cancer. We've got EGFR, ALK, ROS1, BRAF, particularly V600E, where we can treat that, NTRK fusions, RET, MET, HER2, KRAS, particularly KRAS G12C, and PD-L1. So it's a world that's rapidly expanded over the last several years. And I think it's important to make sure that within our practices and institutions, all of the potential biomarkers are included in the panels that we're using, and that we're not just doing a focus panel for two or three of these, because we're now up to around 10 or so biomarkers that should be tested in patients with non-small cell.
It's important for our colleagues and everyone to understand that in the non-small cell lung cancer world, we are testing everyone all the time, reflexively, as you pointed out just a few minutes ago. And the testing is based on the fact that there's a non-small cell lung cancer, but not necessarily just the histology or the clinical parameters of the patient, but testing for these biomarkers helps identify a potential treatment that can be a game changer in how patients are treated and their prognosis and their outcomes.
Absolutely. Let's talk about, I think this is a really fun section, talking about the ways to test for these biomarkers, specifically kind of this ongoing debate within the field, different ways to practice between just using the tumor sample or tissue-based testing or liquid biopsy blood tests. Just curious, your practices, is there any difference in what particular setting you may be in and how you do that? And how do you think about doing one or both?
You're absolutely right. You know, I think because of certain limitations of tissue, and we will talk about that in terms of trying to get an adequate sample or how the tissue is processed and where it is being processed and held, many of our clinical colleagues have also fallen on doing peripheral blood circulating tumor DNA profiles. And that's caught up a lot in the community practice, as far as I can tell. There are, of course, some caveats and people I'm sure understand about, and we'll discuss about that for a second. One of the considerations for circulating tumor DNA is, of course, the good quick turnaround time and the ability to find the marker. If you do find it, the specificity is high. The test is probably truly correct in terms of being able to pick it up. The drawback is, of course, when there is a concern for tumor shedding, or there's not adequate amount of circulating tumor DNA in the blood, or if the sensitivity rates are in the range of 60 to 70%. So there's a false negative rate that you can have, which then allows for a slip, as I might say, if one just relies on the peripheral blood. So many of our colleagues in the community are looking at doing concordant testing, sometimes because the tissue is not adequate and they don't want to just rely on this. But in other circumstances, it's to try to improve pickup rates. There's been a lot of acceptance of peripheral blood for circulating tumor DNA.
Absolutely. I think, as you noted, the specificity of the liquid biopsy or circulating tumor DNA, that if that finding is present, it's accurate and actionable, and the turnaround time are the biggest appeals to me. I think reality is that I do still think that tissue biopsy is the gold standard, mainly just because of sensitivity, that it's higher than the liquid biopsy. But over time, and as we've seen the use of these biomarkers within practice, that turnaround time can be a major factor. One anecdote that I think about and what really this type of scenario that you see intermittently has pushed me to send tumor and liquid simultaneously. You know, patients with very aggressive disease who you want to know whether they're going to be eligible for an oncogenic driver seem to have a particularly poor prognosis. Getting that information within a week can be a big deal. One patient of mine, newly diagnosed, had a moderate smoking history of probably anywhere from 20 to 30 pack years, which impacts the likelihood of finding a targetable mutation. We sent both the tissue and liquid, but sometimes our tissue assay can take up to 3 to 4 weeks to get the result. And so they were progressed all the way to the ICU before we had tissue results. And we got liquid results with a KRAS non-G12C mutation, a TP53 mutation. So we have more closure that in that case, it was actually not that they had an actionable mutation, but there was, you know, tons of push from the family. Can we do a pill? Can we do a pill? When we have that information quickly, we know that it's specific and that these KRAS mutations, by and large, tend to be pretty exclusive of other oncogenic drivers and associated with a smoking history. Scenarios like that, I think, can be very helpful. We've gotten the information, and subsequently, it was corroborated by the tissue, which we see good concordance between tissue and blood, but tissue can pick up mutations that blood doesn't. And the converse scenario that I think about is a patient with no smoking history, I'm much more cautious to draw conclusions from a liquid biopsy, particularly if that liquid biopsy doesn't have other mutations. If it's just nothing detected, then you probably don't have much tumor shed. And so really waiting for the tissue in those scenarios, and maybe even repeating a biopsy if you don't have sufficient tissue for a patient with no smoking history, who you don't identify anything on liquid biopsy, I think is an important component there. And I think it can be helpful to also kind of talk about just the fundamental difference between our PD-L1 assessment, which is an overnight immunohistochemistry stain, logistically in the pathology lab done the same way as TTF1, NAPSIN A, those diagnostic biomarkers, and next generation sequencing, and kind of how next generation sequencing has evolved from the initial tests for EGFR and ALK, which many times were single gene tests for a specific canonical EGFR mutation by PCR, or just testing for an ALK rearrangement with FISH. And what the research has shown is that it's actually inefficient to try to do these tests piecemeal rather than to do a full broad-based biomarker panel. So not sure, I'm curious, within your practice and experience, do you still have much single gene PCR going on or much FISH going on?
Yeah, so firstly, I absolutely agree with everything that you just said. There, non-small cell lung cancer is a difficult disease. You want to know it treatments quickly. There's a lot of awareness on the patient population about testing and how it can apply to their near and dear loved ones for treatment. But coming to your point about evaluation with single gene panels, et cetera, in our center, we are doing reflexive next generation sequencing, which is the broad-based testing. But you're right, still, I do see many of my community oncology colleagues still having reports in their hands, which are potentially single gene tests or sometimes multiplex PCRs, but many times these are not broad-based genetic evaluations. And therefore, there is somewhat of a drawback in terms of how to interpret these. And sometimes when these patients are referred to us for further evaluation, we somehow have to go back to the drawing board and start rechecking everything again, just to make sure that we haven't missed something that might have not been done. So there is potentially a gap that we would like to catch up with and cover in the community practices. Some of that might be just related to where the tissue is procured and obtained. Some of that is related to the local standard in the hospital, in the community hospitals, and how the test has been done in the past, and whether there is a change in the paradigm in terms of their testing. Of course, as you say, you know, tissue is still the more important thing. We cannot make a diagnosis of lung cancer through peripheral blood, and would certainly caution for that. And PD-L1, as you rightly pointed out, has to be still done by the tissue. But these are quick tests that we can turn around. And where it comes to evaluation for the broad-based genetic testing, the reflex testing considerations that we brought up a little while ago has been something that we have seen in our center to be very helpful. The pathologist is able to get a lead on doing the test. And by the time the patient is able to see us, we many times, if not all the times, many times we are able to get some results. And it is very helpful to sort of see, especially amongst the most important markers, and sometimes some markers which are potentially investigative in nature, to decide for the future as to what one would want to do.
I think that this has been a great discussion on those techniques. And to perhaps sum up just a bit, I think for our guidelines are noting that there's a couple standard practices for doing this biomarker testing in patients with non-small cell lung cancer. One that some folks are choosing to stick with is tissue first. And if tissue is insufficient or there's issues there, then to reflex to liquid biopsy assessment or the concomitant or simultaneous tissue and liquid test. So for me, I'm in that concomitant camp doing them both at once for the reasons we've discussed. And I think it's interesting to see how the field will evolve there.
Absolutely agree. I think as techniques are improving, the turnaround times will improve and the sensitivity rates will also improve for peripheral blood. So hopefully we will be able to do better and more for our patients. Okay, so in this section, we are going to talk a little bit in detail about what our challenges on unmet needs are in biomarker testing in non-small cell lung cancer. So the, you know, as we have mentioned just now, there's been a lot of concern that tissue is not easily available, and there's a whole circumstance of trying to get it biopsied properly, get the tissue accessed properly, get it tested properly, and so that the test results comes in time and in a interpretable fashion for our oncologist colleagues to get a treatment plan set up for our patients. So with that, I will ask my colleague, Dr. Eames, to give his inputs about what he thinks in terms of what the unmet needs are in the academic circumstances, but overall as well.
Absolutely. I think turnaround time is still the biggest unmet need. Sensitivity is a bit of an unmet need. And then making sure that we have the full breadth of testing is a major unmet need. So I'll just take those one by one. So the turnaround time, I think there's multiple factors in the process that lead to that. The reality that next generation sequencing takes time to do. It's not just an overnight stain. This is DNA sequencing with technology that's evolved from our original Sanger sequencing approach, but still takes a matter of days at least, and typically over a week. And you've got to get the tissue cut. You've got to get it sent to these labs that are doing the broad-based testing. Those labs have quality control processes that the tissue has to pass before the sequencing can actually be completed. And then, of course, you have the reporting step. So the multiple steps in the process contribute to the turnaround time issues. I think making sure that the testing is done reflex and refinement with technology over time, I'm hopeful that we'll continue to improve the turnaround time, which is one of the most important factors for our patients. Sensitivity is another, that's a particular area of research focus for me, is the evolution of the sensitivity of liquid biopsy assays. There's fascinating new approaches. I won't get into too much detail, but seeking to really increase the sensitivity of detection of tumor DNA, particularly for our MRD or minimal residual disease applications, but can have big implications for the liquid biopsy sensitivity so that we don't miss things as much as we may miss today by just doing liquid biopsy. And then finally, I think that making sure that the broad-based testing is done is something that I see. And when I look at the data about getting all biomarkers tested, I think it's just a reality of process change over time has been at times imperfect, as it always is. But we only had a few biomarkers that were relevant initially in patients with non-small cell lung cancer. So in-house labs created, you know, a single gene PCR or even a multiplex PCR, as you've mentioned, and a FISH or a couple FISH for ALK, ROS1, et cetera. And they did their own thing for these limited biomarkers. But the pace of research has really been very fast. And we've rapidly gotten to 10 or so biomarkers that need to be tested in patients with non-small cell lung cancer. And some processes have just not kept up. So the data noting the lower rates of testing, when I look at the details, to me, it just relates to that process hasn't kept up with the research as it's exploded and it has gone so fast. But do you feel like similar things as far as just process improvement for a broad panel could really cover a lot of the issues we're seeing?
Yeah, good point. I mean, it's process improvements and there are other small things that I think we need to talk about. I mean, it's awareness of testing. As you rightly said, the pace of discovery and pace of data information about treatments and their efficacies and how to incorporate these treatments has really just exploded in the last, you know, 7, 5, 7, 10 years. And then, you know, keeping pace and knowing all these and follow up is an important part of the consideration. You know, if one looks at how the academics versus community oncology practices have looked at, from where I come from in US oncology, there was a trial called the Myelung trial that was evaluated, which suggested, you know, in a huge proportion of patients, when they at least tested for about 5 biomarkers over the last few years, when they, or less than 50% of the people had all the tests, and receive their information prior to their first-line therapy. Of course, over a period of time, the mutational testing rates have increased. EGFR and PD-L1 particularly have taken off and improved. There's been an increase uptick in terms of recognition of these markers. They've been present for a long time, and we have effective therapies that are touted. And therefore, many people have increased their testing. There are reports that suggest that up to 80% tests in community centers have shown EGFR testing. ALK/ROS, BRAF sort of fall back a little bit, but they are still adequately tested. But the incidence goes down as the mutation rates or the mutation incidence gets rarer. Very few of these rarer mutations are tested. And unfortunately, that is a gap in our practice settings. And it may be something to do with how the pathologists and the oncologists share their data, how the tissue is procured, so and how the testing is done. As we just talked about, you know, many of the national guideline institutions will say do broad-based next-generation sequencing. That's not necessarily happening everywhere. Our intention and hope would be that that would be an improvement in terms of my colleagues where they are assessing and discussing with their pathologists. The utilization of these test results may come slowly for patients. As you pointed out, time is also of an essence. And some of my colleagues are hard-pressed to potentially start treating these patients sooner than later. I would, of course, say that in circumstances as such, we do recognize this consideration where patients might have to go through treatment fast in a fashion to help control their symptoms. But potentially, one can tailor these treatments such that we can do chemocytotoxic chemotherapy quickly to try to help control some symptoms, but at the same time, have our mind or an eye set out for these various mutations or markers that can help guide us for or against certain therapies in the ensuing shortcoming future for these patients. My feeling is that there is a need for more awareness of how to do the testing in a broad-based next-generation sequencing fashion in various pathology departments as well as in the oncology community. And I hope that things like, you know, further education, involvement of the molecular pathologists in turning discussion with molecular tumor boards and explaining the various mechanisms of how to do testing, the various paradigms of collecting tissue and testing it, educating our pulmonary and interventional radiology colleagues about getting adequate amount of tissue is where I think things will help change the process in the community setting.
Absolutely. And one thing I'm curious whether you run into it, I'll tell you the landscape at our institution, I think reimbursement, and we don't want patients getting big bills for these tests. And we hope that our reimbursement processes keep up as well. So we do typically bill insurance for these tests, and many times it's covered. Sometimes insurance is not covering these tests. Fortunately, in those circumstances, we work with Tempus and they have a very generous financial assistance program. So it's very rare for patients to owe anything, at most $100 for this next generation sequencing testing. But are you seeing issues with reimbursement and barriers there?
Certainly there. You know, the reimbursement is definitely an important point that you bring about. You know, while I was getting ready to talk about this podcast, I was reading some information where I was dismayed to see that there was a paper that suggested that, you know, only 10% of the actionable, you know, of the reporting costs were being covered by payers. And there was a huge gap between, you know, denials and acceptable outcomes for patients where, you know, there are treatment options that are available for our patients. And if payers don't cover these, it becomes a major issue, then testing doesn't happen. And then we never get to find out whether there are these rarer actionable alterations, genomic alterations that we can use to help our patients. So it definitely is an important thing. I'm hoping that as the awareness of these tests continues to rise in the community and in the insurance industry, people will start understanding that it is an important part of our therapeutic, sorry, or actually I should say, diagnostic landscape, without which we cannot move forward with treatment in non-small cell lung cancer at this day and age. And it's only going to get more complicated as we are going to have hopefully more markers that we can assess in the future.
Absolutely. And just, I think a good point to getting close to the end here is noting with these advances in oncogene-directed targets, we've actually expanded also to patient populations who previously may not have had these options. And what I'm alluding to there is the fact that particularly patients with KRAS G12C mutations can have really significant smoking history. So we certainly don't avoid biomarker testing in any of our non-small cell lung cancer patient populations. And when you look at the data from big clinical trials for these oncogene-directed targeted therapies, it's usually single-digit percentages, 1% to 3% of patients with squamous histology as well can have these mutations, particularly MET exon 14 skipping mutations. So we're also not only treating or only testing our adenocarcinoma patients now. We're testing all patients with non-small cell lung cancer. It is rare in those with squamous histology, but possible. So wondering what you're seeing as well regarding those additional factors, smoking history, squamous histology, is that impacting testing that you're seeing?
Yeah, so I think clinical parameters have had an impact in how our colleagues will ask or not ask for testing. And I think it's very important, as you pointed out, that people understand that all non-small cell lung cancer patients should be considered not just on the basis of histology or issues in terms of what their clinical characteristics are, whether it's just a smoking history or not, should not play into account in terms of testing. It is something that is known to occur. And of course, as reflex testing takes into consideration that we just see a diagnosis of non-small cell lung cancer, hopefully that will override this consideration of limitation in terms of clinical parameters, because we certainly do see squamous cell patients sometimes who have a marker who could be treated with targeted therapy. We see patients who have a long-term history of cigarette smoking and still have a marker, which, as you rightly pointed out, in certain cases are very much present. And sometimes there is still a rare marker which can be evaluated for gratifying treatments for those patients. So it should not be something that should be limited only to a certain population of clinical parameters. And it does happen, and we hope that over a period of time that continues to evolve such that everybody is tested with non-small cell lung cancer.
Absolutely. I think that's a good segue into our conclusions. And in conclusion, thank you very much for your time and joining us for this discussion. I think that some key points that we've noted are the importance of broad-based testing for all patients with non-small cell lung cancer, regardless of stage, including all of our actionable biomarkers, which are 10 plus at this point, in patients with non-small cell lung cancer, understanding some of the process details, how NGS is really the way of the future and efficient, and being keen on refining those processes within all of our institutions. Dr. Kunduri, other conclusions as well?
Yeah, so from a community perspective, I would say that understanding how these tests are done and how to interpret them, the uniformity of tests, is an important thing for our community oncology colleagues, and learning with the help of a molecular tumor board, with a molecular pathologist to help guide you and understand what might or might not be a variant of uncertain significance versus a real actionable driver, et cetera, would be a leap for the future where our patients will get a better treatment opportunity instead of just being evaluated on clinical parameters. The take-home point from a community perspective would be to engage with our pulmonary and pathology colleagues to come up with a plan in your own institution such that you can have these tests with a broad-based next-generation sequencing testing, and perhaps involve the help of a molecular pathologist as the landscape is growing very complicated to understand what may or may not be a therapeutic treatment option.
You are listening to an ADIS podcast. You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS podcast with your preferred podcast provider or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements, please read the article on the journal website.